Like Tim said, my name is Mark Magruder. I'm a counselor and a teacher at the Life Institute. It's a nonprofit organization wing of our for-profit company, wealth management tax advisory firm, the Life Financial Group in Douglasville, Pennsylvania. We also have an office in Chandler, Arizona, and I'm licensed in about 16 or 17 states across the U.S. So part of this trip is visiting with a client who came to see me this morning, and I go visit some other clients next weekend. I go up to Salt Lake City and Idaho and Omaha, Nebraska as part of this trip. I have grandkids in Southern California, grandkids in Alberta, Canada. So I get to, part of my work prayer was, Lord, how am I ever going to see these grandkids? And now I get to see them pretty abundantly. So I feel pretty blessed to do that. This is my third Rocky Mountain Men's Prayer Advance. I know there's one on the East Coast. I never go to it because I have business and family out here. So I met Pastor Craig probably 4 years ago in Hawaii as an introduction from a mutual friend, a pastor out there that I taught at his church. And then Craig and I just kind of hit it off during COVID and during power outages and everything else. We've met in restaurants. I met his wife, and we've just had a good relationship. So I like to come here and bless this organization and this advance and give some advice and direction on a pastor and his finances. Now, about half of this is for pastors specifically, but half of the presentation can be applied to anybody's finances. It's not a salvific issue. It's not going to change your salvation. It's not, you get enough education from well-scholared people on evangelism. That's not what you're going to get today. But you're going to get practical applications on how to be even a better steward of what God's blessed you with. So it's not just being a steward of your finances, it's about your time and your talent as well. So the parable of the talents, I like the word talent anyway, because it could apply to your music skills, it could apply to your financial investing, or it could involve your time. What are you doing with everything God's blessing you with? So I want you to think about that. If you don't have a handout, Drew will give that to you, put your hand up. I do have a large print if you need a large print one. And there's lots to fill in there. If you miss it, don't worry about it. There's ways we can send you the answers if you'd like. And then if you have any questions, I'll try to end 10 minutes early. We're kind of squeezing this between a real fun activity and the weather just broke from shooting guns to a steak dinner. And I'm going to talk about taxes and finances. Exciting, right? We'll try. Let's open everything in prayer, though. Lord God, we thank you for this beautiful day you've made. Thank you for the rain that Colorado needs. When it rains, it pours, and when it's dry, it's dry. So you're in charge of all that, Lord. We do thank you for the sunny weather we have right now and for the joy we have to share time together and worship you in all areas of personal finances, taxes, investing. It's all your stuff, Lord. Would you give us wisdom, direction, and discernment today so we can bring you honor and glory in all areas? It's all your stuff, Lord. We just want to bring you glory and honor in that. In Jesus' name we pray. So before I continue on, I want to pass out a few of these cards. This, if you want to follow up, you can't use the QR code here because the internet's not working very well. But stick it in your pocket, scan it when you get down the mountain a little bit, pass those out. And then Drew back there is our ministry director, so he can answer questions more about the Stewardology podcast, which I'm handing this out. It's a great educational tool. There are near 200 podcasts. They've got a great search tool on there now. So if somebody asks me about Roth IRAs, I can tell them what I know, or they can listen about a Roth IRA or a 403B or whatever other type of financial question they have. The president of our company and Drew sit down and do these podcasts and get them recorded, and they're for anybody in the public that wants to use them. So that's what that Stewardology podcast card is for. So we have the Stewardology podcast, we have Life Institute, and we have a Life Financial Group, and I'm kind of a part of all that organization. Okay, but I was really encouraged when I got here, and the first thing people were doing was they were reading statistics. So I said, I don't know if everybody wants to hear these statistics, but I was really glad that people started reading statistics. And then we'll go into filling in the blanks, and if you have a question, this is kind of a back and forth. It's not just me lecturing. So if you have a question and you want me to stop, I will end about 5:05, give you 10 minutes before the end of the session is 5:15, and then we can answer questions. If you have specific questions about your own pastor finances, your own personal finances, or stuff about your church, we can couch that for a later time, and I can keep that confidential. So most of the times, personal finances, people like to keep confidential, and I respect that. By law, I have to, so I can't share. A pastor tells me somebody is a financial mess, and I can't tell him that I had a meeting with them, and this is their financial mess. I'm not allowed to do that. Nor can I share that a pastor has $1 million to a church congregation either. And some pastors have millions of dollars with me because they opted out of Social Security and they became good savers. So I'll tell you a little bit about that too. But 98% of pastors feel some level of financial stress in their family and church and work, right? 90%. 76% of pastors know other pastors who left the ministry due to financial pressures. 63% of pastors' spouses work outside the home because they need to make a financial difference in their home. 25% of pastors have medical bills averaging over $7,000. 31% of pastors work a second job to help make ends meet, whether they're working at Home Depot or somewhere else, they're taking a second job. Around 60% of pastors do not receive health insurance or retirement funds from their church. And this is all from the National Association of Evangelicals. So it's a general term, different pastors. More conservative churches, I'm finding, are supporting their pastors. So if your church isn't supporting your pastor with some sort of retirement, some sort of health insurance, I would say talk to an outside group like ours, and we would encourage them to find a way to do that. So pastors today, more than days gone by, have financial challenges. We see this all too often when we do one of our Life Institute seminars. And that's what kind of Drew is here for, is to offer those services to your church. If you want us to come in and do a three-day seminar, you want to talk to Drew. From the pulpit, Drew is a 28-year pastor. We're very glad to have him on board as our group. And now he's been with us for about 6 years. He goes around the country with me and some other financial advisors. And he teaches from the pulpit. I usually do teaching Sunday school or Monday night. We talk about finances. We bring in an attorney on Tuesday night, talk about long-term estate planning. It's a very good tool for your church to use. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it encourages people to be generous givers. We're not tied to the Levitical law of 10%. So don't get that in your heads that we're going there to tell people to give 10%. We want them to be joyful or generous givers, right? Drew talks in the Greek, and he says it's a hilaro, I think is the Greek word, which means hilarious. We're supposed to be so joyful about giving, we're laughing about it, right? It's really fun when you can give away money and have joy in your heart. It's a really good feeling. So we see this all too often when we do one of our seminars that things are a mess. Not all pastors, but more often than not, we meet a pastor and his wife, and they share with us their own financial challenges, and some are just like with the other congregants they're dealing with, right? They have credit card debt. They have tuition to pay for their kids. The kids are in college. They have nothing saved for retirement. So we want to help them get on track too. And that's why we're here today, is to help to see, help you understand the challenge, to challenge you to solid biblical financial stewardship in your personal and family life. So pastor's personal finances, so that the more you hear about a pastor's personal finances, and how they're out of control a lot of times, or they're in debt and they're trying to save for college and save for retirement at the same time, we bring them back to the scriptures and we try to ground them in. We're supposed to give and save and spend and we have offerings and luxuries. I'll talk about that, and that'll be part of your first fill-in stuff here. So the word has one way to work our finances and the stewardship, and the world has another. So our word, the word of God, has one way to look at stewardship, and the world has another. So the world says we should, buy now, pay later. You deserve a break today, things like that. But God's word teaches us to give. So your first fill in there is give. God asks that we take his first fruits of his provision and return a portion to him. This is from Proverbs. We're supposed to give to the Lord first, right? We're supposed to give our first fruits. So are there farmers in here? There might be. But even if you're not a farmer, it doesn't exempt you from giving your first fruits. Our first fruits is our adjusted gross income. That's our gross income on our tax return. So people ask me if you should give from your gross income or your net income. I say the Bible says give from your first fruits. So what did the person who harvested their fruit first is they gave away some to the Lord, the first 10%, then they give to pay their wages, then they give to feed their family, then they give to buy or barter or trade for things. So their first fruit, their first 10%, went to the Lord. So we encourage you to do the same thing. So people say, I don't have that much. Well, then if your income's lower, then you're not expected to give as much. But it's a good starting point. It's not an absolute, a 10%. That's a good starting point. At least look at that. The next step is to save. The family must remain have financial freedom by having reserves. This is Proverbs 21, practicing wise long-term management. Proverbs 21, 5 and 1 Timothy 5, 8. So if we give first to the Lord and we save second, and we're using a 10% rule on each one, we give 10%, we save 10%, then we have to learn to live on 80%. Everybody got that? As a good general rule of thumb. These aren't absolutes. It's a good rule of thumb. The next fill in there is give, save, spend is the third one. Give, save, spend. Being honest, timely, and just with your creditors. You want to be a good testimony. If you're a pastor and you're not paying your bills off and you're in debt, what kind of testimony is that, right? So this fulfills our ethical obligation and supports our consistent testimony to the world around us. 1 Peter 2:15. Then we to look for offerings or the needs of others. So if we give, save, spend, offerings is the next one. In response to God's bounty, you've given to the first fruits to the Lord, you've saved, all your bills are paid, credit card debt. We don't like to see any credit card debt. There's nothing wrong with offerings, looking for the needs of others, ministry work, and the other ministry that's here, Wings of Eagles, isn't it? Yeah. It's a good ministry. I've looked into that as well. I support some ministries, and you know, nothing wrong with giving to the needs of others, or even like a Focus on the Family, or even a Salvation Army. It has a Christian base, but it wouldn't be a ministry work per se. Nothing wrong with those organizations as long as your other priorities you've taken care of. So giving should be to your church first, right? Should definitely be for your own church, because Focus on the Family isn't going to come and visit you in the hospital. Or if somebody's injured or you're having marital issues, they're not going to come and help you with your marriage. That's up to your own personal church. So give, save, spend, offerings. The last one's luxuries, the last one. So there's nothing wrong with luxuries. There's nothing wrong with a nice car or a nice house. But if you're getting that nice house at the expense of giving to the Lord, it's a bad thing. So everybody do this for me if you want. We teach this in our seminar. You can leave with this. I'm giving you this information to take it home with you. You all got a hand up? You can take your hand home with you. So we want to give, save, spend, offerings, and luxuries. Okay? Everybody out loud, ready? Give, save, spend, offerings, luxuries. What's the world do? The world flips it around, wants you to buy now, pay later, right? Do this. Put a $5 in the plate for the Girl Scouts or something like that when you're walking out the grocery store. Pay half of your bills. Nothing gets saved for long term, and who gets shortchanged the most is the Lord. But if I had to lose one of my digits, I wouldn't be taking off my thumb. That's the most important one. That's God, right? If I had to lose a digit, I'd rather lose my pinky, which is my luxury. So if I had to start cutting expenses, that's where I start cutting expenses, okay? So keep it right side up. Don't flip it over. You can take that home with you along with your outline, okay? All right. So now let's look at the framework, the skeleton, and some practical application. Let's talk about budgeting, okay? In Proverbs 21:5, it says, "The plans of the diligent surely lead to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty surely to poverty." So if you're diligent, you will be prosperous. It's not a full guarantee either. Not everybody who's diligent to save avoids cancer or avoids a bankruptcy or avoids a divorce. But generally, I find in my work, 9 out of 10 people who are diligent savers, they have plenty because they've gotten used to living on less and they've gotten used to saving more. Does that make sense? None of this is a guarantee. None of it is salvific. Okay? All right, so a pastor needs to live on a budget is your next fill-in. And if you're married, both of you need to be on board with your budget. My wife doesn't like to get involved either, and I bring her in kicking and screaming, and I say, here it is, so at least I've done my job of at least keeping her informed of what's going on. If I pass away, I've given her the contact at our office. Everything's outlined in account number form where everything is. Don't keep things from your spouse, and sometimes the spouse is the one that handles everything, and if that's the case, maybe she's got the financial degree. At least get involved with her as the husband of the family and say, we should go over this together. If something happens to you, I need to know what's going on. So that's not a gender issue. Both people should be involved in the budget. A budget is giving your money a placeholder. You're telling it where to go. So you don't want to have your money telling you that I'm going to be spending on this spur of the moment purchase. So when you see something, you don't have to buy it. If everything is budgeted and labeled, if you're in a tight budget situation, we're pretty loose now because I don't have kids at home, we're debt-free. So we just kind of have a $50 range that neither of us have to worry about, that if my wife buys something and wants to get nails done and it's $45, I don't even need to know about it, right? Because I know she's trying to save money. But if it's $450 to get her nails done, I think I ought to know about it, right? So generally, our purchase is over $50. You can draw the line wherever it's material for you. Maybe it's $5. Maybe it's $500. I don't know, wherever you draw that line. So budgeting is giving your money a placeholder. Like I said, if you do not live on a budget, then your money will tell you where it wants to go, or your feeling or emotions or your eyes will tell you where it wants to go, and you will be living in a financially tight situation, or you'll be overspending compared to what you earn. So don't let your emotions, your eyes, spur-of-the-moment purchases take over. Have a plan for it. And if you need to plan for a little bit of a leeway, then you each get a $25 or $50 a week allowance, however you want to do that. Does that make sense? So create a budget using those five biblical principles that we shared about. Now, we have a spreadsheet on our website, thelifeinstitute.org. If you scan that QR code, it'll take you to Stewardology Podcast. But thelifeinstitute.org, we have a spreadsheet. It's in Excel format. It's easy to download. But we've organized it for you in those five priorities. Giving is the first section. That should not be compromised. You should be giving to your own church. You should be saving second. But at the bottom, we have categories for luxuries, like eating out, like cable TV, like eating out, like a subscription to a magazine, like eating out, right? So maybe eating out, you're getting the idea. You don't need to eat out all the time, right? So my wife bought chicken thighs the other day, and I wanted to know the budget of it. They were like 87 cents a piece. It was 10 pounds for $6 or $7, something like that. And they were like some, and I said, so this whole meal is costing $3.50. And if I go eat at McDonald's for $5, I think I can save $1.50 to have you cook a meal and package it up and give it to me the next day. Well, for $1.50, it's not quite worth it, right? It's about a break even. But if I'm eating out and it's $20 for an eat out for a hoagie or a sub and fries or whatever else, then it can be $20. Then it's worth $3.50. So then you have to decide if it's worth eating out or not worth eating out. But I think the coffee lattes and frappuccinos, and I can't even pronounce half of them, are very expensive for a $5 drink. That if you do that every day, $25 a week for 50 weeks a year, you're talking $750 or more, right? So that's a lot when you add it up for the whole year. So think about eating out or coffee's eating out. Your budget should be broken down in those five priorities. So give heat and electricity and those sort of thing. So give a tithe to start with and grow from there. If you're only at 2% now, if you figured it out, go to 4%. At least try to get to that 10%, and it should be to your own church first. You can't outgive God. I have brought some people back, some 25, 28-year-olds that are giving 20, 25% because they love giving, yet they had $30,000 of college debt. So it's one of the few times I've said, don't give so much to your church, but very seldom will I pull people back. Get your debt in order first, because if something happens to your job, you're still going to have that debt, and the church isn't going to pay the debt. So pay your 10%, tell the church you're just changing it a little bit, get your debt paid off. A year later, she feels so much better, single lady, paying off her debt, and then she can give that 30% without any, I have to worry about paying my college tuition off. So it's the only rare time I've told people to give less to your church. I do tell people many times, stop giving to your church out of your checking account, and that's more of a tax strategy than it is giving, right? When people hear me say, stop giving out of your checking account, it's not really stop giving, it's just out of your checking account. Older people can give directly out of their IRAs and save the tax on it. People that are under age 70 and a half that can't give out of their IRAs can give out of their appreciated stock. You can give away vehicles to your church, and they can sell it that way too. You have to ask your church if they want it that way. But if your church doesn't have a brokerage account, somebody could set up a brokerage account, and I can give Microsoft, and you can give Apple, and the church can get all these stocks, and they can sell it and put it in as part of the general fund. So it's a nice way to give away stock. If I have an appreciated stock I don't want to sell, but I could give them the appreciated stock, and if they sell it, they're a nonprofit, so they don't pay any tax on it. It's a good strategy. These are kind of the nuances. Yes?
Sorry,
No, that's exactly what I want. So
just backing up on don't give out of your checking account. Can you elaborate on that?
So if you have other assets to give away you haven't paid tax on yet, any money that's in your checking account, you've already paid tax on it. right? So if you've already paid tax on it, you give it to the church, and they raise the standard deduction, you know, in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in 2018, standard deduction's now over $25,000. So if you give $10,000 away, you're getting no tax benefit for that. If you're in a 15% bracket and you could save 15% on that deduction, that's $1,500 on a $10,000 gift. However, if you have appreciated stock somewhere outside your retirement money, you can give that to your church. If you're over age 70 and a half and you have a large IRA, give out of your IRA and you don't pay tax on it, but it counts as your required minimum distribution. And then you've satisfied your required minimum distribution, the church gets a check and you pay no tax on it. Some good tax strategies. But that may be something for you specifically. I'd have to look at your tax return. You don't have to share what you make here. But maybe you are getting a deduction for your taxes already on your Schedule A. Maybe all this is Greek to you. I don't know. But I'm a tax guy also. So if I see an area where you can give less to the government, I have a real disdain for anybody paying any one nickel more to the government than they legally, morally, or ethically have to. And everybody in this room would agree with that, right? But I know we have to pay Caesar what is Caesar. Jesus looked at that coin and he said, render, who's on the coin? Render under Caesar what is Caesar's, right? But he didn't say render under Caesar more than what's Caesar. I know we drove here on roads. I know we have military that protects us. I know we have police. All these things are taxable dollars. But I don't like the government spending $300 on a toilet seat, right? So if I don't like the way they're spending my tax dollars, I'm going to give them only the minimum I have to give them, no more. Okay? Same thing with refunds. There's no big reason why you need a $6,000 or $12,000 refund. Hey, I got a big refund. Well, that just means you're giving the government an interest-free loan. Put it in your own investments and pay them a little, right? They'd love to take all your money for a year and give you no interest rate on it. Okay, I diverted, but thank you for the question. I appreciate that. And anything specific to your own personal tax return, I'd be happy to do an online meeting with anybody, and then we could share that information online confidentially. Yes, sir.
On that same issue, if you don't have appreciated stocks, or you don't have, you're not 70
plus. Yep.
Is there any other options besides using your?
Sometimes it takes a little time to save into a non-retirement account. I've done that with people too. Very good givers are given $100 a week. It's $5,000 a year. If you could put another $100 in another investment, that $5,000 that you've also saved, maybe $6,000 in a year. So either you can give away the $5,000 and keep the $1,000 for yourself, or give away more. But it has to be a little bit of a planning. You're right. At this moment in time, you may not have it. It's a great question. So how do you get there? Save for it, plan for it. Sometimes you get inherited stuff too. Okay? Make sense? It may not be instant. Some of these things aren't instant. It takes a little time. Okay.
And then the temporary, you use your checking
account. Yeah, you can use the checking account. You can also lump your giving together if you have a large amount in your checking account. You can give for the regular tithe for the whole year. Then December of this year, give all of next year away. So if you gave $5,000 this year and you have $5,000, you can give it to your, or $10,000. Let's use $10,000 as an example. You've given $10,000 away and you want to give another $10,000 next year, and you have it just sitting in checking account, you can give that to your church in December, tell your church it's for the next year, and you've bundled or grouped your giving in one taxable year. The church gets it in December for the next year. I don't know any church, if you're on a $500,000 budget for your church and they got all $500,000 December 31st, the day before the year started, hallelujah, you met your budget, right? It's their job to be stewards of that for the rest of the year. But you get the tax deduction for that year. Now, the reason I use $10,000, because it moves the needle. You need $25,000 to deduct it. And if you have $20,000 in charitable giving and $10,000 in taxes and $5,000 in medical, then you're at $40,000. So one year you're getting the itemized deduction of $40,000 and $15,000 more than the standard, and 10% of that's $1,500. The next year you only have $10,000 in expenses because you no longer have the charity, but you still get the $15,000 more than you actually gave away, because the government wrote the law that way. So you can choose to take the standard deduction or the itemized deduction. And every year, if you take the standard one year and the higher itemized the next year, every year you're saving tax dollars. And I did tell you my disdain for paying any more taxes to the IRS, right? So if you can get $1,500 back and you can get $3,000, you can get $5,000, this is all helping our cause, right? And if you don't care about the $1,500, ask if your church if they'd rather have $1,500 more from your charitable giving, right? Every church would like that. I did this with a little old lady with $20,000 a year. She'd withdraw it out of her IRA. She'd pay the tax on it. She's in a 15% bracket. That's $3,000 to the IRS. She gives the $20,000 to the church. She pays the $3,000 to the IRS. And I said, you don't have to give that to the IRS. So we can give it directly out of your IRA right to the church, and that satisfies your RMD. But I have to take my RMD. That'll satisfy your RMD, and you get an extra $3,000. Well, what should I do with it? I don't really need it. Give it to your church. I meet with six of her girlfriends at a ladies' breakfast. I say the same thing. They all start giving that way. Well, each one of them doing it, I don't know if every one of them saved $3,000, but let's say five of them save $3,000, $15,000. Well, that was a nice breakfast to have with those ladies, right? So, and if I do this at this conference with 10 or 12 people, and I do it at another conference with 20 or 30 people, eventually it snowballs into everybody's giving more generously and joyfully because we're all keeping it from the government, right? And I know we have to pay some taxes. I'm not a tax evader. I'm a tax avoider, right? And on their laws, when they change the law back, because the Tax Cut and Jobs Act passed, and I'm really going to digress, but when they passed the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in 2018, everything was bad. I'm paying more taxes. Everybody I knew that made less than 100 grand saved taxes, because it really was a tax cut and a jobs act, more jobs and tax cut. But everybody who made more than $200,000 were only able to deduct $10,000 of their state taxes. That was their limit. Used to be able to deduct all of it. So this liberal states are now complaining people can't deduct their high state taxes. Instead of complaining you're paying too much tax, they're complaining they can't deduct it. Don't get me started, right? I would rather complain I'm paying too much taxes because they're losing people to Florida. The New Yorkers moving to Florida is like a stream. They're just all going down there, including Trump, right? I don't want to make it a political issue, but it was his Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And it really did save a lot of taxes, except for the wealthier people. So, okay, so we talked about giving first. Let's talk about short-term and emergency savings. Savings. Save even when you are not making much money. So your unemployment, by the way, is income. If you're on unemployment, the Lord's in control. He will find you a new job. You're supposed to tithe on that. That is part of your first fruit. It's less fruit, but it is still your first fruit. Do you understand? So I always say, not out of pride, but out of joy, before I took this job, I was on unemployment. From April 15th, I was let go as a tax manager, to August 3rd that year. I still had unemployment income that year for those period of time. I still tithed on my gross pay. And I said, Lord, if you want me to give more, I know you'll find a way. Which is kind of joyful, because then when I make more and I make more, I can give away more. That's the joy of giving, right? So short-term and emergency fund savings. Short-term is the next one. So breaking these down, the short-term money is something you need in the next 12 or 18 months. If somebody has $50,000 in the bank, I ask them, what do they need it for? And they say, I just want it there. And it should be for an expense you have coming up in 12 to 18 months. We'll talk about Dave Ramsey and the 3 months of worth of expenses a little bit later. But if you don't have a plan for that money, remember, you should name that money to be used for something else. You can put it in a fund that you can get the money out. If you tie it up in a CD or an annuity, you might not be able to get it out. So if I know you're thinking of buying a house, you're 25 years old and you're saving for a house, but you don't know if it's 3 years or 5 years, you should do something with it that you can get the money out. Does that make sense? Liquidity. People understand liquidity. Illiquidity is an annuity. It's a contract. You can't get it out. CDs might have an expiration date. Sometimes the CDs are worth canceling it because you lose 3 months worth of interest. But now 3 months worth of interest may be 2.5% or 2%. So you don't want to lose money by taking it out early, okay? Short term. Emergency fund, money tucked away when non-budget things break. Everybody owns cars and washing machines and dryers and air conditioning units, and they all break. They're all machines, right? So you have to have a way to fix those, and that you should have in your emergency fund, three months worth of expenses. Shoot for the $1,000 and increase this as you can. Dave Ramsey talks about if you have nothing saved, go for that first $1,000 and it'll make you feel better that you can get that first $1,000 saved up. Does that make sense? So once you get that $1,000 saved up, then you have to figure out what your budget is. And if your expenses are $5,000 a month, you should have at least $15,000 in the bank just designated for emergency. If you lose your job, if you if you're sick or something like that happens, you have at least your next 3 months paid for. Now, if you're a seasonal worker, construction or sales, when the sales are high and low, or you're only employed at Christmas time for full time and the rest of the year is part time, then maybe you should have 6 months worth of expenses. But these people who have hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash, I don't understand it. Peace of mind in your cash is not any better than peace of mind in a diversified portfolio. Okay, long-term savings then should include high-yield savings accounts. Look into online banking if you want to do something with your cash that's liquid. Alibank and Capital One 360 are paying over 5% now. So if you need it liquid and you can transfer it on your phone back and forth to your checking account, they're good. Roth IRAs are very good because a Roth IRA is coming from your money in your checking account. So if you don't have a Roth funded, I tell people at the end of the year, you could finance a Roth with $6,500 for each in the couple. That's $13,000. And then in January, do it again because that's two calendar years. So that's $26,000 you can move out of your checking account if you had it to do it. And what's nice about the Roth IRAs is your contributions are liquid. So if you needed your contributions out for a house in 3 to 5 years, you can take out your contributions, but your growth has to stay in there until you're age 59 and a half. So the nice thing about the Roth IRA saving for a house, a young couple, dual income now, let's say they're right out of college earning money, no children, if they save $13,000 a year for 3 years, $39,000, they can take that out. The $39,000 is likely grown to $45,000 or $48,000. They can't touch the growth, but that $39,000 is a 10% down payment on a $390,000 house that they were wondering how they were going to save that. And by not putting that money in a checking account earning nothing, they have another $6,000 to $8,000 for retirement. They just did it by saving that little bit of a change, moving it from a bank account to a Roth.
Yeah. You say it's okay to have your 3 months of expenses.
Pardon me?
Your 3 months emergency fund, is it okay to have that in a Roth?
Nope, it has to stay out of that. You want it to stay into a check and into some type of bank account, earning nothing.
Okay.
But that's why we do only 3 months there. Yeah.
Okay.
If you're really aggressive, you can put that 3 months expenses in an Alley bank. And if you're good at transferring it, like the next day you need a washer, you can transfer $500 from your Alley bank to your bank account and use a debit card to buy the washer.
Okay.
So my wife calls and says the washer's gone. So we have the plan. Just go get it because, well, that's another issue. But paying off your credit cards in a month, I'll talk about that in a little bit too.
Yeah.
All my credit cards are paid automatically.
Okay,
in a month.
Liquid with the Roth.
Liquid is to cover your expenses.
Yep.
Yeah, car, education, that sort of thing. I say the same with kids saving middle-aged people saving for their kids' college. You can really max out your Roth IRAs, and then if your kids are going to college and they fill out that FAFSA form, their retirement accounts aren't counted as assets to be used for the FAFSA form, but savings in the bank is. They want you to spend your money in the bank down before they give you financial aid. They don't want you to spend your Roth down. However, let's say you get a financial aid package, it's a $40,000 a year college, and you get a financial aid package for 30 grand because you don't have as many assets, you could still take 5 grand out of your Roth and give it to your kids.
Yep.
It's still like in the double emergency savings plan, right? And the kid could raise 5,000. So I'm very big on the kids have some skin in the game. Let them work all summer and spend it all on college, right? And you put in 5,000 and their financial aid package is 30. It's a great way to get through college without having debt. I know a lot of International Baptist College and Seminary in Arizona is very good at this. They want to graduate those kids with no debt. They're very good at teaching that because they want them in the mission field that year. They're young, they're fresh, they're good. You were talking about that. Where are all the young people? So they're trying to do that, and getting them graduated debt-free is a very good tool, a very good idea. I just support them on that. Yeah.
So there's no tax penalty for taking Roth money out that you
if you're under age 59 and a half, you can take out your contributions only because you didn't deduct them. A Roth, you don't get the deduction up front, but all the growth and the withdrawals and retirement are tax-free. Since you didn't get the deduction in the current year, you can take out your contributions at any time. Tell your tax preparer, I took this out as an early distribution, but it's only my contributions. So if you're working with a financial person that keeps track of those contributions, then you should know every year I put in $6,500. Well, 1 year you couldn't, maybe you put in $2,000. Somebody has to know that. Your financial company that you're investing with should know that too. So I'm surprised how many don't, but they should know that. We keep very good records of it. So if somebody says I need a withdrawal, I'm thinking I have this tax-free money I can take it out. But yes, it's a great question, and it has to be reconciled on your tax return. The 1099 will say you're underage. And then on your tax return, you're basically reporting, yes, I know I'm underage, but I'm only taking out my contributions. Yeah.
That's for Roth IRA.
That's a Roth. Traditional IRA, you take out early, you're going to pay tax, and you're going to pay penalty. So Roths are great. And Roth is only the name of the senator who did it, William Roth out of Delaware in the 90s. So it's just he got his name labeled to it. Most of these 403Bs, 401Ks are all IRS codes. And I just know them because that's my lingo, right? So I do speak quickly. So that's what a Roth is. A Roth is a tax-free retirement savings plan. And it's tax-free because you've already paid the tax on the money you're putting in. Okay? Great questions, though. Thanks for participating. So the other long-term savings is a 403B. Again, it's a 403B, 401K. A 403B is a retirement plan for a nonprofit organization like a church or a Christian school. A 401K is a retirement plan for a for-profit organization. So rather than say those big long words, we just call it a 401K or 403B. A 457 is a government retirement plan. Just different codes for the same type of taxable or non-taxable. Okay? And now they've labeled some of these 401Ks and 403B Roth 401Ks because they let you put it in tax-free. And then there's some controversy lately of can the employer's contribution, matching contribution, be tax-free? And all this has to be reconciled. So they wanted to pass the law to make it effective this year, and the fund company said, whoa, it's too fast. We can't get our computers changed that quick. Congress likes to change these laws and then just let them worry about it, but they said they just can't do it. So they did extend it for them. At least Congress listened to that. They want to give you the option of a 401k Roth, but they didn't think about, do we even have the capacity to do it? Okay, that's our government. Okay, so the next one is spending. Give, save, and then spending. This is an area of our budget we have to talk about that gets difficult a lot of times, the usage of credit cards. Credit cards themselves are not evil, right? And does the Bible say money is the root of all evil? You guys are well educated here, right? It doesn't say that. It says the love of money is. So money is just a necessary means of exchange, and so are credit cards. I might have 7 or 8 credit cards. I don't even know anymore. I just keep getting new ones here because they give me such good deals. The first thing I do is put it on automatic payment because I know I'm not going to put enough on there that I couldn't pay it off. I leave enough in my account to pay it off. But if I get a free 2 bags checked and I get 60,000 miles on American, and I do the same with Delta and Southwest and all these other things, Southwest has got their bag, I must have 6 or 7 just airline credit cards. So I don't have to worry about it. I find the cheapest airline because I know I get 2 free bags. And I did this years ago, and I use all those miles. And I actually give people the mileage anyway. I fly family around or missionaries. That's a good joy, too. So when I don't use a credit card for a while and I see that $95 come up and I said, well, I haven't used it all year, I then cancel it. Of course they're going to write me back and say, hey, we'll give you a deal for 60,000 more credit, and you get $100 to come back and things like that. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with credit cards. Just make sure you pay them off, okay? You want to have your limit to be outlined in your budget. So you don't want to, they're going to give you $20,000 limits, $15,000, $30,000. If that's too much limit for you to handle, you can ask them to lower it. You don't have to take their $20,000 credit card limit. You understand? You can take 5, and that way you're limited to 5. I know people who do 1,000. They want the credit. It's good to have credit, but they don't want to have that spending temptation. And do that limit. If it offends you, you're we're to cut it off or pluck it out, right? Go ahead, your question.
If truly nothing is free and somebody always pays for something that other people get for free, who's paying for those free flights? Who's paying for those free rewards you get when you spend those credits?
Great question. I haven't analyzed that too much. But the theory is that you're not going to pay at one of these times, right? And then they're going to get that 27% interest. So there are some people that won't pay it off. What's the big deal if I get a free bag and 60,000 miles? I still have to use their airlines, and that gets used up pretty quickly. They also get to use my money for the month, but they don't get to use it for more than a month. So banks float money on days. I mean, there's pennies, and a penny moves billions of dollars. That's how the bank. I'm not in the banking industry, but that's how I figure that. It's a great question, though. I should look into it a little bit more. But you're right. They're not giving it away. They want me to stay on board and spend money with them. Yes.
I know that I've owned several businesses, And I know that with certain credit card companies, like Discover is a big one, they give cash back. It is the merchant that accepts that credit card that pays a higher fee, transaction fee to that credit card.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
So it's the merchant that's paying that cash back to them.
Yeah, so merchants can say 2% discount for cash or something like that because they know they have to pay a fee on it. Yet if I don't carry cash around, the theory is I'll pay 2% as a merchant if I get more sales.
Exactly.
So it's a give and take, but it's a great observation. It's good thinking. Okay? So for pastors now, don't spend your own money for church expenses. We encourage pastors to have an expense account. One of my interview questions when I talk with a pastor, are you using your own mileage and your own expenses and own cash to take people out? That should be put through by the church so they should have an expense account, a reasonable expense account, and the pastor's job is to stay within that. So if a pastor's driving to multiple hospitals and nursing homes and his visitation, he should have a budget for that many miles, right? Make sure that's covered for your churches. Find out what the church expense account is designated for and use it for that one, and make sure you stay within those limits. Don't mingle your personal and church credit card usage. If you have a church credit card, use it for church stuff. If you have your own personal credit card and then you try to get reimbursed, it gets a little messy. If you have a church credit card, it's also controlled and somebody else should be looking at it. It's very good to keep it all on the up and up, and somebody should always be looking at it. Somebody told me this week, I think it was you, Stephen, that anytime somebody wants a church budget, they can go in and get it. And our church is the same way. I think it should be pretty visible for everybody to go get their church budget. So living expenses is the next fill-in there, living expenses. Owning a home, we highly encourage you to work towards owning a home. We think owning appreciating assets are good, especially in Colorado or Arizona, or really across the country. Home values are going up. I know it's hard to get in. Mortgages are very high, which is really, people don't want to leave their 2% mortgage and buy a new house with a 5 or a 7% mortgage. So that kind of limits the supply. But we use 30% as a kind of rule of your take-home pay to what you could afford per month in a house. So 30% rule. Much more than this could put you in financial constraints. So, but if your final payment's going to be 45% of your combined budget for the month, then maybe you need another house, right? Don't buy that expensive house. It's okay to rent for apartments or rent a home for a season, but work towards owning your home. Maybe a rent to own. Ask the owner if they're planning on selling anytime soon. Ask them if you could be the first offer. Maybe some of your rent can go towards a rent purchase option. Yes. Go ahead. I thought you were raising your hand. Go ahead.
I did, but go for it.
No, it's all right.
Are most rent-owned places the case where you're the one that's basically owning the home without paying for it? So if you're renting a place, you don't do all the repairs, the water heater breaks down, your landlord pays. Are rent-owned places where you're doing all the payments yourself on the repairs?
Yeah, each one's individually, so we call it a triple net lease if you do nothing. So people who want to rent to own, depends who's in the driver's seat. If you're good at fixing things up, maybe you can say, I can fix repairs up to $500 as an offer to that person. And that owner of the place would say, great, I don't have to worry about, you know, a new toilet is less than $500, right? But if the whole air conditioning unit goes, in my place in Arizona, I got it fixed in a day, but it was $13,000 at 90, 100 degrees, you're not going to wait for the air conditioner guy to come for 2 weeks, right? So anything over a certain amount. It's a great question. It's all personalized to that rent to own. Yeah? Great question. So living in a church parsonage, we're not big fans of this for a long period of time. It's great for younger pastors just starting out, and I think it's great for encouraging them to come on board. Listen, for the first 5 years, you can live in this parsonage and you don't have to pay rent. It's a great way to do it. However, if they live in a parsonage and they're 55, 60 years old and they've never owned a home, what happens if that pastor dies? Can the wife live there till she's 90? Most likely not. So that's why living in a church parsonage, you want to make sure you still have a savings plan for that house. If the pastor dies at age 65, the wife has somewhere to go. We want to make sure she's taken care of. And the church should take care of that, too. They should know that. What are you doing? Or ask the pastor, what are you doing to provide for your wife so she has a place to live? It makes wives very nervous when all of their living for the rest of their lives is all dependent on that ministry. Just telling you from experience, right? That's one of these non-pretty things. We like pastors to serve. I like churches to provide for their families, not just the pastor, right? So I have a pastor that lives in a parsonage, pays nothing. It's a very expensive high rent district. He's got a rental property he's had since he was in his 20s. That was the house he was going to live in. And then he decided to rent it out, moved to New York, kept the rental property, gets that rental income every month. And that's where they're going to move to when he leaves or he dies. They move that person out of that rental property and they have a one-year lease every 1 year. So if he were to die, that lease would come up and she wouldn't renew the lease and she could move back to that property and 50 or 100 miles away. Does that make sense? Rental properties are good for stuff like that. Okay, so that's about the church parsonage. So insurance is the next fill-in. Insurance is life and health for pastors or for people in general. That's what I said. This is for pastors and his finances, but it really could be for everybody. Life insurance is to cover, we like term insurance to cover a short period of time or a period of time, usually 30 years for a 25-year-old. Is great because by the time you're 55, most of your kids are out of the house. You should be debt-free except your mortgage, and you only need it for that period of time. And you're building up your savings in retirement. I don't like whole life for the low benefit that you get because my younger people need millions of dollars of insurance to cover their income for the rest of their lives. Make sure a pastor also has health insurance. If they're living there in their own government health insurance, maybe you should supply that for them or at least pay that for them. Next fill-in is debt. You're either earning interest or paying interest, one or the other. And if you're paying interest, you're living in debt. And we understand good debt and bad debt. A good debt is a 2.3% mortgage now. A bad debt might be 29% interest on $20,000 of credit card bills. So you see the difference there. So I'm telling people to pay. This is where I differ from Dave Ramsey a little bit. He wants you to pay off the smaller ones first. I'm big on let's get rid of those 29% ones first. So I like the snowball approach too if you have multiple credit cards, and then I don't care about the interest rate. But you don't want to pay your mortgage off first and leave the credit cards there. Does that make sense? Okay. Living with that on a pastor's salary is not wise. It's not wise or it's not good. It's also not being a good example to your church. And it's not that people will know that, but you and God know that. So you should be holding yourself accountable for that. Come up with a plan to eliminate debt. That's that debt snowball. Dave Ramsey talks about putting a list down of your smallest to your largest and paying off the smallest one first. If the smallest one falls in there that's a mortgage, I sometimes will waive that. That's kind of what I meant. I do like paying off all the credit cards first. But if a mortgage gets mixed in there and your mortgage is only $10,000 left, but you have a credit card of $15,000, I'm going to try to pay that credit card off before the mortgage. Okay? Usually the home is the biggest debt, but...
Are you a fan of paying off a mortgage?
Well, it depends on the situation. So if my wife wanted to pay off the mortgage early, we paid off our mortgage, but I still have a debt on my investment or my other property in Arizona. I don't need to pay it off. If I die today, all the money's her and she can decide what to do with it. I think paying off a 2.3% mortgage on interest or investments that I'm making 15% on is not a good idea. But I have enough money in tax-free Roths that she could take a lump sum out and pay off that whole mortgage if she wanted to. Then I'm dancing on streets of gold. I really don't care. But at least it's her decision. it's not a right or a wrong thing to do. But I don't mind some good debt on property that's earning me more or... If I take $120,000 out of my investments that are earning 10% to pay off a 2% mortgage, and I get a deduction for that 2% still, right? Yeah, so each individual case is a little bit different. What's the peace of mind worth? How much are you arguing about it? How many times do you come in and I have to break up the fight, right? So pay it off. I don't want to argue. Yeah, it matters, right? It matters to some people to pay it off, but I'm not a big fan of, hey, let's pay this off now. I am a very big fan on credit card debt and medical debt and these debts. Even if you get a 0% loan, I'm okay with leaving that sit there. Some people do that on purpose. Hey, the car company gave me when you could get it. People had millions of dollars with me. They get an interest-free loan for 3 years. Well, of course they take it. They could pay it off tomorrow if they wanted to. But when they were there and drove off with the car, they signed a 0% loan. Okay? All right. So using that debt small, paying off those smaller ones, when you pay one off, use that same amount to the next one. When you pay off that second one, use that same amount that you were paying off and snowball it into the next one. So you're making the payments bigger and bigger. Drew is excellent living on a pastor's salary for so many years. If you want to talk about more of budgeting and debt elimination, Drew would be happy to do that. I'm more of of when the Lord blesses you with this, how do you honor him and glorify him in your giving and your tithing and that sort of thing. I'm more of a wealth manager. So the last one was the debt snowball. Works amazingly well. Got that? Next fill-in is offerings is giving and generosity that is above and beyond your regular tithe. So if you give, save, and spend, offerings comes in when you're looking at focus on the family or any other ministry work or things like that, supporting a missionary, local charities, giving to your church buildings fund, helping a neighbor with groceries. It's really fun to give somebody, you know, $100 for groceries because you know they're struggling. And you know who these people are in your church. Or if you don't know, talk to your pastor. He hears them all the time. They have a benevolence fund for that sort of stuff. But how much nicer is it you just go give somebody a Baptist handshake and they end up with $100 in their hand? It's a really neat, oh, really, they cry or whatever. Take your kids out to, you know, Dairy Queen or something like that. It's a really nice feeling to do that. And then luxuries are anything above and beyond is your next fill-in, what you need to live on. So there's nothing wrong with cable TV, depends what you're watching, same with internet, streaming services, eating out, vacations, fancy car, all of the above is fine. We know some very wealthy people in the Bible, David and Solomon, for example, but they had to have the heart for the Lord and have everything in the right priorities, right? Now that your budget priorities have been set, let's talk about the pastor's specific information, W-2 or 1099s. We recommend a W-2 for a pastor. They basically have a dual tax status. This is the pastor section now. Under federal law, most ministers have a dual tax status. Dual tax status means a minister is an employee of the church for federal income tax purposes, but is self-employed for Social Security and Medicare. So they have to pay both halves of that on their own. According to the IRS, ministers are individuals who are duly ordained, commissioned, or licensed by a religious body, or a church or an organization, a nonprofit organization. So the IRS labels them as a nonprofit organization by the code 501c3, another IRS code, and they have to be registered with the IRS as a nonprofit organization. The other special provisions for a pastor is they're eligible for housing allowance, so some of their money can be excluded from income tax purposes, and they're always self-employed for Social Security, so they have to pay both halves of that. They're exempt from automatic federal income tax withholding. They don't have to pay it, but they have to make it up eventually at the end of the year. And pastors can opt out of Social Security. I'll talk about that in a little bit. The housing allowance part of it, that's the next line to fill in for pastors. Housing allowance is set by the pastor. So a pastor can add up all their expenses, I say, except paper products. They can't deduct toilet paper or tissues. Everything else they can pretty much deduct. Gasoline for your lawnmowers, paying somebody to fix things, putting in new windows and curtains and things like that. Rent, utilities, cable, furniture, all are housing allowances. If they add it all up and it's $50,000 and your pastor's on a $60,000 income, you can deduct $50,000 from income and they pay tax on $10,000. Doesn't usually work out in that ratio. Yeah.
When would a pastor have to account for that housing allowance?
Great question. So when they say exclude $50,000 from my income as housing allowance and they submit with their tax return $45,000 in expenses that actually happen, because when they do it ahead of time they're guessing, they just have to pay income tax on that extra $5,000. So some pastors underestimate. They say, I estimate $45,000, but my actual expenses came in at $48,000. I say, well, you're giving up a $3,000 deduction.
So what about receipts?
Yeah, you're supposed to keep track of all that, pastors. Keep it on a spreadsheet, scan everything. You only have to prove it to the IRS when they doubt you or you come up in a random audit. Only 2% of the people get audited. So I'm not encouraging you to be dishonest. We have to report to the Lord first. So there's nothing doing wrong here. But I keep track of all my receipts. I'm not a pastor, but I just scan them all and I keep it on a spreadsheet. So if I get audited, I have it and I can show that to somebody. I don't want to be a bad testimony that I'm telling people this stuff and I don't take my own advice. Pastor should have the same thing. He's reporting to the Lord first, right? But this is a very good tax law, tax loophole to use.
Mortgage payments
on there. Yep. So I tell pastors, pay a whole lump sum out of your mortgage to pay it off, out of your 403B in retirement, if you're going to die. If you know you have cancer and you're going to die, increase your expenses because your wife doesn't get those benefits. That's a really individualized strategy. But I have a couple pastors I'm on a watch list. If they start ailing, we're going to pay off their mortgage and take it out of a lump sum because you take it out of a taxable account, they at least get the deduction for the housing allowance. Great questions, though. So sometimes a pastor has a Schedule C. Schedule C is the next fill-in for outside church ministry, speaking engagements, weddings, and funerals. Keep good records of this. Write off your expenses. If they're not written off anywhere else, your cell phone, mileage for that event, write them off here. You don't have to not write them off. I tell people, if you're paying both halves of your Social Security and your income tax on a Schedule C income, and somebody gives you $400 for an event, and you don't deduct $100 out of it, it's costing you $25 not to deduct the $100. 25% of whatever you don't deduct. So keep good records of it. The government lets you do it. So here's where I talk about Social Security. Are you in or you're out? And really, you're supposed to have an objection, a conscientious objective to socialize insurance, right? So we want to make sure that you really don't want to pay in because you can do it yourself. But make sure you're funding your own Social Security. Okay, you have to have the discipline that if you're saving 10% on your own, maybe you should save 25% if you are going to opt out of Social Security. So you make sure that you're saving that. So my million-dollar pastors have $1 million because they had the discipline to opt out of Social Security and save another 15% into retirement. So their retirement savings plan has been 25% for 40 years. If the government did that and gave you back what you put in, you'd have millions of dollars. But they don't. They give you a fraction of it back. And then they tax you on it again because they can. That's a whole nother issue. Okay, let me finish our sheet here. So you will need a Christian's will as the next fill-in. You need a Christian's will. In your will, you want to have a will, financial power of attorney, and a medical power of attorney. In a Christian's will, we want to make sure that we're leaving something, save at least 10% of your income for retirement. That's what we encourage. And you can leave your beneficiary to be your church or the church you're a member of at that time. But if you want to give something to ministry, make sure you spell it out. You don't want to die and somebody say, yeah, I know they wanted to give something to ministry. If it's not written out, it doesn't get executed. Okay? So open up a Roth is an action point that you can do. You can focus on making a living budget. Use that spreadsheet that we have. Avoid debt and reduce or eliminate it if you have it. We believe that not everyone needs an advisor, but everyone needs advice every so often. So consider reaching out to us if you need help in those areas. Some of you have already used our services. We're offering a free online meeting with anybody, or if I'm in your area, I'll sit down and talk with you. Like somebody came here and I met with them earlier today. Is there anything I didn't fill in for you guys? I know the questions are great, but that was the 10 minutes I was going to take at 5 o'clock here. I wanted to make sure we covered everything.
I missed all three of you. What documents do I need?
What documents do you need? You need a will, financial power of attorney, or medical, and a medical power of attorney. Okay? Just because you're married for 40 years, when you go to the doctor's office now because of HIPAA laws, doesn't give you a right to each other's medical records. It also doesn't give you a right to each other's financial records. Now, us older folks think that's silly. My wife can know anything about me, and when she has medical issues, I want to know about that too. But now the law is just because you have a medical issue, the doctor doesn't have to share it with your spouse unless you give him permission. Same with your finances. Yep.
Do you recommend the online websites for setting up a will? Or?
So we use a national organization called the National Center for Life and Liberty. It's a Dave Gibbs organization. You can use your local attorney, but we like to use a Christian because in a Christian's will, they're going to put your testimony in it. A will becomes a public document after you die, and your great-grandkids can look you up by the courthouse in your will, and you can put your testimony to Jesus Christ right in your will. You could be saving people from the grave, those great-great-grandchildren. Talk about really, really saving people. I mean, you're not saving them, but you're at least giving them your testimony where you stand. Oh, this is why our family has this great endowment or something like that. It's NCLL, National Center for Life and Liberty.
If you're interested in using NCLL, my email address is at the bottom of the sheet there with Mark and I, and plus my card is in the back. Reach out to me. I would gladly introduce you to NCLL. They're friends of our ministry, and they will hook you guys up. They love working with
them. And they can still do a state-specific will to Colorado.
Yeah, they're licensed in all 50 states. That's why a national organization like that's good. Now, if we teach at your church, if you like what you hear and you want Drew to come and teach, I'll come with them and do the counsel, the financial counseling. But he really teaches the budgeting and the stewardship from a biblical worldview. He really teaches that well. We would then, depending on the size of the church, bring an attorney with us, either from NCLL, which we've done in the past, or we ask your organization. If you're a large enough church, you probably know a Christian attorney you like to work with. And then we would recommend them. So, yeah, anybody who needs to go, I'll stay here and answer questions till you know, till whenever, but it is 5:15, so I don't want to take anybody more time. But I love this question and answer. Thank you for participating. I hope it was beneficial for everybody. I'm going to turn off the recorders now, okay, and then I'll just stop and answer questions.